Grave Tone.
Welcome to Grave Tone Podcast, where horror comes to life in every form it takes. I'm Megan.
And I'm Arthur.
And we have a super, super fun, extra special little bonusy interview episode for you guys today.
Super special. That super, is
right. I have all of the words that I can think of. Terrific, wonderful, fabulous, spooktacular. I don't know.
I'm out super of, interesting.
I'm yeah. out of I'm out of words. You do. You go.
Anyways, so yeah, we spoke with Mike P. Nelson last week, and we're finally dropping this interview today, right now.
Yeah.
You're listening to it right now.
Huzzah.
You know him from, you know, he written and, he directed The Wrong Turn.
The most Wrong Turn reboot in, what is it, 2021? Yeah. He wrote and directed not only one, but two segments in VHS 85, which I would argue is one of the strongest of that entire franchise, and most recently wrote and directed the reboot of Silent Night, Deadly Night, which came out in December of this past year.
Yeah, and it did really well as well.
Yeah.
He's also working on a new movie that's supposed to come out somewhere in the summer. It's a creature feature about a giant snake in the Amazon. So yeah, all of that, we are talking to him about it. We're talking about, you know, the movies that he's worked on, the movies that he's currently working on, what he likes, what he doesn't like, what inspires him, what scares him. Yeah. It's just a big kind of horror nerd fest.
It is. It's a big horror nerd chat. So much fun. This was such a great conversation to have. I think we're hoping to have many more of them in the future. But in the meantime, I hope you guys enjoy this little super special bonus episode. So Mike, thank you so much for hopping on with us. We're really excited to kind of just talk a little bit about sort of like some of your experience in filmmaking, some of the franchises that you've touched on, and kind of like the original stuff that you're working on, and sort of, I don't know, I mean, like kind of how you got into all of this, which I guess is maybe sort of generic, but it's kind of my first question is sort of maybe like, why horror? What got you into it? Because I think you've mentioned in previous interviews that you weren't really allowed to watch it growing up. So I guess I'm curious as to like what kicked it off and I guess like what drew you in the first place, like what your major inspirations were and what drew you to the genre in general.
Yeah. I mean, growing up, it was, you know, I loved all the Universal monsters. You know, the stuff that I was allowed to watch, obviously, left a mark on me. So, you know, I remember, you know, I think it's somewhere back on that shelf, actually. It's recorded off TV, James Whale's Frankenstein. And I mean, gosh, that was one that I remember I was in my parents' first house, which meant that I was either 5 years of age or younger. And I remember watching that several times. I was like the go-to tape. It was that one. They were all recorded off TV. So it was like Star Wars, New Hope, Frankenstein, Raiders of the Lost Ark, Temple of Doom, when my dad was in a good mood because he didn't like me watching that one, even though that's like one, that's like my favorite one. I love that one. That one has a special place in my heart. And then of course, like I knew of all like the, you know, the Wolfman and the Creature and the Mummy and stuff like that. And so I was allowed to watch those. So was, of course those, you know, left a huge mark on me. And so that was sort of, honestly, that's kind of how it all started, and, you know, having the toys that was really it. And then, I of course always liked to take things a little bit more extreme than maybe my parents would have liked, but then of course, you know, well, honestly, then, you know, at a very young age, I believe, gosh, I had to have been 5 or 6, very young. I watched Monster Squad. Like, it was my godfather, who was a really good friend of my dad. He had a huge movie collection. It's basically like when you went over to his house, it was just like you're walking into a little mom and pop video store. Like the basement was just like shelves of just VHS tapes.
Oh, and they were awesome. All the real movies. Those were the best people growing up. The people, you know, who had like all the movies.
Wood paneled walls. He had a Beta deck and a VHS deck. He had like the big screen, the projection screen, and then he had the normal. It was just like he was all into the tech. And he had a version of Monster Squad. He didn't have the actual VHS of that one, although he eventually did get it, and he gave us the one that he recorded off of HBO. So it had like the HBO logo that came up, and you know, you know. And I remember watching that with my dad because he was like, if Mike likes, you know, Dracula and the Wolfman and all that stuff, because he's going to love this movie. Yeah. And of course, it was pretty extreme for a 5 or 6 year old kid. My dad wasn't happy about that, but we watched the whole dang thing, and it was it left an impression for sure. And so after that, I realized, oh, monsters can be like really mean, and like there can be blood, and I mean, and kids can be involved. Okay, I'm in. And I think, you know, after that, God, I remember, I think, so it had to have been after, because yeah, I had to have been that young when I saw it, because I remember like one of the first stories I ever wrote, like, and I believe it was in kindergarten. It was literally about the Wolfman eating somebody. It was like the first like handwritten story, and I drew a picture, and it was the Wolfman, and it looked like Lon Chaney, Wolfman, you know, with like the pants and the red shirt or whatever, and then it was just like blood on the mouth, and of course my teacher was very concerned.
Of course,
my dad was like, "Well, let me tell you, he's this is what he loves to do." And so I think again, the long-winded answer of it did start somewhere. That's kind of where it started, and I just you know, when I could ever sneak a peek, I would. But it was just growing up until finally I just got to, you know, I was old enough to go to the R-rated movies myself.
Right.
Yeah. And I just went all in, and I just had to do a lot of catching up. I am still catching up. There are people who are like 400%, you know, have seen way more than I have. And I am still, they're like, have you never seen that? I'm like, nah, dude, nope. And they're like, oh, dude, I saw that when I was like 15. I'm like, yeah, see, I wasn't watching them when I was 15. I was. So, yeah. Anyway, that's where it all started. And then, of course, finding my dad's video camera, the big shoulder rig, carry around the deck and this hand, this in this hand, with the telescoping mic. And then it was just making movies with friends, you know, at a very young age, and just continued to do that. And then the cameras got a little bit better, and you know, I got a camera for Christmas, and then went off to school and got a little bit of a better camera, and just kept making stuff. That was really it.
And now you can just make movies with your phone, apparently, because yeah, everyone has a camera in their pocket.
So. I mean, shit, man, if Sean Baker can get out there and do it, anybody can, you know. It's it's pretty cool.
That's awesome, though. Man, your dad had a good camera set up for even the time, like an actual, like proper, like a deck and everything attached to it. That's really intense. It's not something that you saw. Most people just had like a little handheld like camcorder, and it was like, okay, I'm gonna make a movie with
this. Well, no, but see, this was before the little handheld, like it was literally the only size you could get.
Oh my God.
Like an 80, what was it? It would have been, he got that thing, was it the year I was born? Or so it had been really early 80s. Mm. So these things were not, nothing was small yet. There were, I think, cameras. Actually, I think the more expensive, like the cooler ones, is where you could put the tape inside and close it, and it was all one unit. That was like, that's technology.
Yep.
This one was like a little bit older of a build, where like you had the deck that you had to carry along, so you actually had to lug around this like 10-pound thing with, you know, a 10-pound camera on your shoulder.
When you're seven and you're like,
Yeah,
I'm gonna do that.
Exactly, but we made it happen. But what was cool about that deck was you could actually plug in, and you could mix, like if you wanted to, you could mix different audio in over stuff that you had shot. You just have to press. There was a dub button.
Wow. You'd hit the dub button,
and if we wanted to put punching sound effects in, and we didn't want to do them on the day, we would have to time up, and we'd have to know like when, how far the tape would go back, and then how far it would creep forward. And then we'd be ready, because it would cancel out the sound that you'd already recorded.
Oh,
and so you had to be ready. And then it was like, and then, all right. And then you'd stop it. So then no other sound could get, it was
insane. Oh, that's okay.
Anyway, good times. You know, we went through it.
That's awesome. Look at what it's led you to, and things like Monster Squad. Right. And I mean, like you started with the classics, like with Universal Monster stuff and everything too. And then like Monster Squad, which just does its little updated version of things. Doesn't Dracula blow people up with dynamite?
100%.
It's so good.
Yes.
Why wouldn't a kid like that movie? It's just a bunch of kids running around swearing about everything. And Dracula blows people up with dynamite. That was every 80s movie, to be fair. It was just a bunch of foul-mouthed kids doing things that they weren't supposed to do. Yep. And you really, really rooted for them. Every time you watch anything from that time period, that's what you get.
I mean, but that's kind of how it was.
Yeah.
That's how kids talked. That's kind of what we did. You know, it was back home when the streetlights turned on and
you got into shenanigans. Yeah. Your parents genuinely had no idea what you were doing for the entire day.
Seriously, I think that was the era.
It was the last era where that was happening. Yeah.
Now you have tracking. You know exactly where your kid is. I used to leave my house at like 8 o'clock in the morning, not come back until 10 p.m. My parents had no clue where I was.
Nope. And nobody was that worried.
No, that's true.
No.
Anyways, that's a whole other conversation. I know.
Yeah. But anyway, yeah, that's it. It's led you kind of to the place that you're at now. And you've been able to step in and work on these like really cool, like well-established IPs with like these kind of iconic franchises, which is really fun because you've been able to like to do that, to like kind of revamp something that already exists to a degree, which, you know, arguably Monster Squad sort of did with like Universal Monsters in its own way. Is there something about inherited IP and working on franchises, like existing franchises to a degree like this, but doing something completely different with them that draws you to a project specifically? Because I'm thinking of things like obviously Wrong Turn, and then more recently Silent Night, Deadly Night, of course, and like both
the better Wrong Turn, I would say.
Agreed. Yeah.
Exactly. Same writer.
Yeah, but he made it a full story. But good for him.
God, you know, I'll be 100% honest. I did not think going into this that I would be helming these sort of B horror franchises or IPs, you know what I mean? Obviously celebrated and loved. But I never expected it. It wasn't like I was going after it. It did sort of, I don't want to full on say fell into my lap, because it was still something I like when I read something or when I was like called up, hey, would you be interested in this? Like I had to put the work in to like try to get it. Like they're not just like, you get this movie, go take it away. It's like, no, they want to hear what you have to say and what your vision is. And so you do, you have to like sit down, you got to try, you have to like really focus in on like what you want it to feel like, what you want it to look like, who would you like to see in it? Like all these things. And so I think it was after I did The Domestics, which was an original that I wrote and it was like my first Hollywood feature.
Yeah.
I was like, Wrong Turn came along and I was like, oh boy, like never did I think I was going to be doing that. But I read it and it was good. I was like, this is a lot different than I was expecting. It feels like its own movie. But it feels enough like it has the Wrong Turn DNA, kids in the Appalachians getting lost in the woods and a tribe, you know, of strange people find them and take them or kid or kill them or whatever. And so, and it had this new take and I was like, oh, this is really cool. Cause it feels like it really does feel like its own thing. And that was, I think, eye opening to me, because not only did it, you know, did I love the story and I love that it kind of told this like trifecta, this like story of like these liberal city kids who meet up with kind of redneck conservatives and then a weird group of communist socialist psychopaths in the woods. And I was like, this is so fantastic. Like you can do so much with, you know, stories that, you know, have been told, and you can retell them in new ways. And so, I mean, then, you know, when you had Silent Night, you know, get brought to me, and that was, you know, Brad Miska, who I did VHS 85 with and loved working with him on that. And he's such a cool dude. And he was like, hey, we're looking for a take. And I came up with a take that I was like, I knew that if this movie didn't take it, I could technically make my own Santa Claus movie with it if they didn't want it, you know? And that was the thing. I think that's what it came down to, is I needed to be able to tell my take and tell a unique and original story. Obviously then when, you know, I got the gig, it was kind of like, okay, what do I really love from the original that I can bring into here to really still keep the DNA? I mean, one of, and obviously the main thing was, is Billy Chapman. Like, yeah. Billy is, to me, has always been Silent Night, Deadly Night. And to bring him back in this new way was exciting. And, you know, of course, starting off the movie in a familiar way, so you feel like, okay, we're back in this.
Yeah, we're kind of in it.
World. Yeah.
And then it goes, yoop.
Yeah, that was what was so cool about it. That was why we had such a good time with it, was that we were like, okay, what kind of a reboot are we getting going in? Like, I had no idea. I was like, what kind of a reboot are we getting? Are we getting like a full remake? Are we getting something that's slightly different in some way? And then basically as of what, a couple of scenes in, something completely different happens to Billy's character that leads him into like his entire, like the entire sort of trajectory that his character takes for the rest of the movie. And it was so unexpected, and had such an interesting twist that you don't get. Well, when you watch the original movie, you're like, of course he's crazy. This poor kid was like traumatized in the orphanage that he grew up in and everything. And I felt, more than anything, the first 30 minutes of that movie, I was like, this is awful. This poor child is being like abused by these people in this nunnery. And it's so sad. And no, so no wonder he turns out the way that he turns out. But this took that, I like a vague idea like that, but it gave Billy so much more nuance as a character. It gives him so much more reasoning, and on top of it, even gives you even more of a surprise twist with like how this has happened to him and really what's actually going on. Why are Billy's parents killed? It's not just a random act of violence. Like, there's more that actually, you know, to that story. And I thought that was so cool. I loved that.
It was very smart. I know. Sure.
It was fun. Like, I mean, it was, again, it was one of those things that it was, as I've told other people, it was, how the idea came about was, again, it was, I was watching a whole bunch of Pixar with my wife and son, Pixar and then freaking Frailty of all movies. And it was just like, and for some, after watching all these, you know, movies, like, gosh, you think about a movie like Ratatouille, right? You know, where it's like literally the chef who's being controlled by a rat, you know, right, what I mean? And like telling him what to do and like how he, you know, and it was sort of that kind of vibe. And then you have a movie like Frailty where you have Bill Paxton who gets told by God, he's given an axe to go murder murderers, you know, and if you're like, but are they? Or is he just crazy? You know? And so to me, I was like, oh gosh, there's something really cool here. And I think I could work in this Billy Chapman story and like bring this sort of like kind of whimsical, kind of, you know, fantastical kind of Pixar elements that kind of make it fun. And like, and it, I don't know, it's more, it's kind of like a ride, but then you have this like dark force and it's like violent. And then you can like, but you can like get revenge on like the worst people in the world. And I'm just like, oh, okay, this, all these things are really coming together in a good way. And yeah, that, and that's kind of where it came from. And that's what, that was the fun of it all. It was just some amalgamation of all these different things. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's crazy how sometimes ideas come together, because I was reading Stephen King's memoir a while back and he said the exact same thing. He would think of like one thing and then he was like, okay, maybe that's kind of like going to be in the background, whatever. And then something else happens and then you connect the two dots and then there's something developing, right? Like, and then there's a whole story about it.
Yes, 100%.
Yeah. That's awesome. I mean, I guess also, I think a lot of people said it when they watched the film, but they definitely were like, oh, this has like a Dexter vibe to it. Mm. It's got like that little like dark passenger kind of feel where there's like something in your head kind of telling you what to do. And it's, of course, to like rid the world of terrible people who are doing terrible things. And by, so it kind of.
By the way, we have to say we spoke with Mark Etchison a few weeks back.
I saw his thing.
Fantastic things to say about working on this film.
I don't know if you had the choice to cast him for the voice or whatever it is, but he was amazing. Such a great voice for it.
So good.
He told us that like you brought an audio studio to his house, which is like, damn, okay. That's so cool.
Yes. Yeah. He was, well, it was interesting because there was one point in which we were trying to get the movie made. This was in 2024. And we were set up to shoot it in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And so we put a casting call out for couple of, I mean, the key characters.
Yeah.
You know, and, you know, I kind of knew who, what kind of people I wanted. But at that point, it was like, okay, we're at so low budget. You got to bring in everybody that's in the movie's got to be from Vancouver. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and I'm just like, oh, okay. So, you know, nobody had read the script. They just were given a couple scenes. And I just remember nobody was really clicking. And the one only person from that casting that carried over into when we ended up shooting in Winnipeg in 2025 was Mark Atchison. And so when they were like, so who do you want for Charlie? I'm like, he auditioned last year. It was Mark Atchison. And they're like, oh, where's he from? I'm like, he's from Vancouver, man. He's like, like, great. He's Canadian. Great. Works for the Tanks and Center. I'm like, he works creatively for me. So I don't care where he's from. He's got to be in this movie. Exactly. And that's what it came down to. And then of course, with the Rowan Ruby of it all, as soon as when we were in Winnipeg and they were kind of like, you can cast whoever you want. Now I'm like, Ruby Modine. I was like, she's Pam. Cause as soon as that was lifted, I was kind of like, I knew I wanted her. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I gave her the script right away and she loved it. And then Rowan came about through Stephen Schneider, who's pretty, you know, Strange Darling. And he did the Long Walk. And I'm just, he's got a hell of a.
Also filmed in Winnipeg.
Yeah, exactly. So he's got a hell of a track record.
Yeah.
And he had just done a movie with Rowan called Violence. And was like, we should get the script to him. And I was like, he'd read it? He goes, yeah, I know him. I'm like, okay. And sure enough, I got on a call with him right after he read it. He loved the script. We talked for a little bit and it seemed like a week or so later, he was like, I'm in. So it was like, I mean, that was as easy as it was to like cast the three leads. It was just like,
Rowan and Ruby were fantastic in the film. Yeah. Like they really tied it together. And Rowan had this really brilliant ability to basically seem like Billy seems like Charlie is literally in his head for the entire movie. Like it's very conversational. Nothing feels forced. Nothing seems like it doesn't match up in terms of like dialogue or his reactions to anything. Like everything felt really natural with what he was doing.
What was it that I read? I don't know if it was you or someone else was feeding him the lines that Mark Atchison afterwards recorded. So the dialogue was very seamless. Yeah. Is that what happened?
I was usually on set. Yeah. So okay. I'd say about 90% of the time I was kind of acting with Rowan, like from behind camera or over by the screen. And then a couple times I had our AD, Reed come in and, if I was focusing in on too many things. But yeah, a lot of times it was just Rowan and I just trying things.
Right.
Very funny that you wound up having to switch locations and everything. And you still wound up with two key players in your cast that were Canadian anyway.
Go figure, right?
Isn't that funny?
It's just, yep, that's how it worked out.
But it was great. It was just like a really great ensemble. Even the, like I would also say, even a lot of the side characters, everybody, Pam's dad, I loved Pam's dad.
David Brown, he was
wonderful.
Yeah, he brought a warmth, a humor. Obviously, when he meets his demise, it's crushing.
Oh,
you know what
so
I mean?
Sad.
Because he doesn't deserve any of that.
No,
but that's again, this is you know, when you're in a horror movie, there are good people don't always make it in horror films, and that's what makes them horror films.
True.
It's a harsh reality at times.
Obviously, I mean, we know that the original Silent Night, Deadly Night was largely panned, and there was quite a bit of controversy when the film was released initially. You know, there were all kinds of protests and stuff because it was just not something that was like seen very frequently at the time. Like it was a killer Santa. It was like besmirching, obviously, like the holiday spirit of it all. So I don't think people were too happy with it. Now flash forward in your version of this, there is, I guess, what could have been a controversial scene, but is really just a sequence that went fully viral before the film was released in the most positive way possible with regards to like the response that you got from it. I can only imagine the first audiences that watched the film before its release probably had some really great reactions to it. So I guess I'm just curious if you have what your feelings are about the differences in terms of, like, I guess, quote unquote controversy between the release of the original film and then something like the sequence, the Nazi sequence. I don't think I'm giving that much away. The film's been out for a little while now and it went viral. Now. Everybody's seen it.
It went viral.
So anyway, but in like the Nazi sequence in your version of the film and sort of, I guess, from your perspective, how you think audiences maybe have changed a little bit in that regard with what they want out of their horror now.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like we've done Christmas horror now, you know, and, you know, there, I mean, technically Silent Night, Deadly Night, the original wasn't the first killer Santa Claus movie. There was others. No, they weren't maybe as, they weren't big and studio backed, like, you know, they weren't, what is it, TriStar or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So that was a huge deal that it was like, you know, putting out in theaters everywhere kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think look, I think times have changed. I think, you know, people want their slashers to bring home the goods. I think people are cool with merging Christmas with Christmas with a little bit of crazy. I think that's I think people are completely over that aspect now. I don't think there's really anything to boycott, or there's not as much sacrilege, I think, connected to it.
Mm-hmm.
That being said, though, it's like, you know, one of the things going into it and what I wanted to do with it was, whereas I wasn't going to go kind of the more, I wasn't going to get so much into the weird, like the abuse stuff and the kind of the skin flick that the other one ended up kind of being.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to get into that, which again, which was a huge deal because it was just like, it was kind of like sacrilege. You're doing, it's like sex, blood, violence. And, you know, like with a Santa Claus, like, oh, this is so disgusting, blah, blah, blah. I was like, there still needs to be these like elements to it that like give it that sort of off color, off color thing, but you know, something off color that like, I'm also like kind of okay with, you know, that, and so again, like, and as I've said before, you know, coming from the Church of Indiana Jones, growing up in that church, from a very early age and knowing full well, I mean, my dad was a military collector. He collected stuff from World War II. And so like, I knew at a very early age, like, who the bad guys were, let's just put it that way. And so that was made very clear to me. And so, yeah, it was kind of like my opportunity to do something kind of off the wall, zany, mm-hmm. A whole room dressed in Santas and elves, and they're all Zeke Heiling. And to me, it was like, okay, I'm going to kind of bring that, like, it's like that sequence in Last Crusade where they're at the book burning ceremony with Hitler there. And I actually pull a line straight from that scene and I put it in that, in our scene. And it's when they walk in and Charlie goes, "We are pilgrims in an unholy land." That's exactly what Sean Connery says in that scene. And that's, I literally just put it right in because I was like, that is where that comes from. That is what that scene is sort of based on.
Yeah, you're not expecting it. I think you're not expecting it in the film. So I'm sure people who weren't paying attention, probably I didn't catch it. I'm sure people didn't necessarily catch it. Everybody catches the Garbage Day reference. Like, I think that's expected and everyone's looking for it.
Yeah.
But not everybody caught that. Oh, that's a really cool like homage.
That's like, and that one is literally just for me. Like I did it because again, it is my nod to, you know, one of my favorite films. And, but it's like in the same sort of, like evil environment, know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that was, but yeah, that was sort of my way to like get that sort of like, again, like I said, that sort of off color, like strange, like what the hell is going on? Kind of vibe that the, you know, it's different than the original, but it was my attempt to do something like that, that gives it that fun, that weird, that,
it's such a cool like, and such a like a surprising interspersed scene. I did not see it coming before. No, I hadn't watched the scene before we saw the movie, and I did not see it coming at all. And it's so well choreographed. Yeah. Everything looks great.
It was fun. I mean, we could have used another day, maybe two, but because I think we shot it in like a day and a half. Oh, like wow. it was, and that was everything. That was like her getting up and doing her speech, the entrance. Like, the we were just Nick and I and my DP, Nick Junkersfeld and I, like he literally had to go in there and be like, okay, so we just need to like be able to like walk lights around, like whatever way you want to turn, we can just do this. And then you want to, we just were able to just dance stuff around constantly. And then we just let some of the pin lights or the point lights just kind of play. And they're just in the scene just because it's a party, you know, you can rent those lights.
True.
So we just, I mean, you had to kind of think on the fly and how we're going to get something like this done, because I don't think any of the producers thought we were going to actually make it. And we did actually have to cut down some of the scene. There was actually more. There was, I think, at least 3 or 4 more like on-screen kills that were supposed to happen that we didn't have time to do. Like we had to make the hard decision and lop off a couple things that we just didn't have the time to do. But it was still, look, I still think we still did something that was pretty fun. And
oh, hell yeah.
Oh yeah.
We had a good time doing it too. Like we used real squibs and air cannons blowing stuff up, and you know, it was so much fun.
So cool. That's really cool. I mean, it really, no, it's paid off though, because it's genuinely, it's such a cool, like new, fresh take on things. And it even leaves things open. It's left open for a sequel as far as I'm concerned. I'm just saying, like, if Ruby wants to come back and do just like her own movie, and then, you know, Rowan wants to step into like a voice role, they could just make another film out of that. And I think that would be really fun.
Well, I have talked with both of them, actually with the producers as well. So like there's a pretty solid idea that I've pitched to both Rowan and Ruby and Scott and Dennis, and and everybody is really on board. It's just a matter of if Cineverse or another entity wants to take it on, because they are in, like they've already kind of said like, yeah, just let me know where we got to be.
That's awesome. They should. I'm going to create a petition.
Okay, do that. Yep. Good plan.
Yeah, the more people that say we want this, the more likely it'll happen.
That's it. We could circulate something.
There you go. Yeah, there we go.
I'm sure. Oh, I have one completely random question, just out of curiosity, with regards to the Silent Night, Deadly Night franchise as a whole, because those movies get weirder the longer you kind of look at them. The outside of the original film, do you have a favorite of the other ones? Am I putting you on the spot?
No, not at all. Honestly, like I know you could even say it's maybe even worse than the first one, but I'd say the second one.
It's so funny
because it continues the story, even though it does use half of the movie to fill out half of its movie.
Yep.
But just the fact that it's Billy's brother, like it's kind of the next best thing. You know what I mean? And that what's his name? What's the actor's name? Is hysterical.
Oh, he's so, I can't, oh God, I can't remember. That's not good. It's like, it's basically my favorite one just because of his entire performance in that film. I don't know who was like either directed him that way or was like, do whatever you want.
Yeah.
We're keeping it. But whoever did that made a good choice.
You know, everybody loves Garbage Day. I personally love Umbrella Kill.
Oh, yeah. Like,
and then just blood flies out. And it's like he's got the guy. I'm like, I've never seen that before. That's incredible.
It's so inventive.
I know. I love that. So yeah. So again, as you said, it's not super great movie, but again, it's zany, it's wild, and I love that, like, you know, it's where are they, was it LA that they were shooting that in, or
like during the summer,
like during the summer, and it's just like I remember before I even saw that movie and I saw the Garbage Day clip, this is when I was a lot younger, I was like, what is this from? And when somebody said Silent, I was like, I thought that was a Christmas movie.
Yes. I think almost no other film in the franchise that follows really classifies as a Christmas movie, other than a couple of them are like, it's winter. And I'm like, okay. Especially when you get into the witch cult stuff. With the slimy bugs. I'm like, what movie are we in right now? What franchise is this?
Just, you know, slap the name on it and people will see it at the video store, and
But yeah, it was made by Brian Yuzna, so I mean,
hey, you know, okay, so this is an interesting little bit of trivia, and is I actually went to college with his nephew.
Jake. Oh, no way.
I didn't know entirely who Brian Yuzna was.
Yeah.
But of course, when college hit and I was like doing my deep dive into horror films, because I was watching everything at that point.
Yeah.
And then I started to realize, and then when he told me, I was like, you got to be kidding me. He's like, yeah, you know, like Dolls and Reanimator. I'm like,
yeah.
What? Yeah. So right. Yeah, we both went to MCAD, which is kind of a fun thing.
Oh, that's awesome.
And he's still here. Yeah, Jake is still here in Minnesota too.
Oh, wow. Right. Okay.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Okay, I guess if I flip gears, because there are other projects, obviously, but I guess if I flip gears, what were the differences, I guess, in obviously working on like a full-length feature, but versus working on a VHS film? Because it's a franchise that's established, but each film is so different, and all of the segments are so different, and the wraparound plots are always completely separate from each other. Like, you know, there's always like a huge difference. And I mean, in your case as well, it was two segments that you created, and you actually tied them together, which I feel like when we watched it, I wasn't expecting to happen at all, because very frequently in the VHS franchise, they tie into the theme, but they don't necessarily tie together multiple segments or even to the wraparound necessarily. There's not necessarily that much of a correlation. It just sort of fits into the overarching theme. But this one had like a full circle moment to it, which was really cool.
Yeah. I mean, I guess, I don't know, other than it being shorter, I mean, God, there were no rules. I mean, I think that's what's really cool about it. I mean, when Josh Goldblum reached out and was like, hey, do you have any ideas? I had met him because he was the one that premiered Domestics at Cinepocalypse in Chicago. And that's how I met him. And so when he reached out, and this was in like 2021, he was like, yeah, we're looking for ideas. We're doing 99 and 85, and we're kind of shooting them at the same time. And I was like, oh, wow. I was like, yeah, let me think of some. He's like, yeah, just send me some ideas, and then we'll talk about which one would work. And I sent him three. He liked two of them, and he goes, you just pick which one you want to do. And I was like, holy shit. I was like, all right. So I picked the no wake idea. Yeah. And, you know, they're... It was an idea that I had had, like I had written this like short, it wasn't fully scripted, but it was like this kind of this short story that I had pitched to my managers at one point. And yeah. And I pitched it to some other people, and everybody's like, this is too weird. This is really dark. It's, you know, you want to be careful with like, you know, the people, the shooters that are out there now, with like the fact that you have a sniper and that's the horror, like, you got to be careful. And I remember my one manager, she's not anymore, she went off and started her own company, but I remember she called me after and she was like, don't give up on that story. This was back in 2018 or something like that. She's like, don't give up on this. She's like, there's something here. She goes, I don't know what it is, I don't know if it's a feature. She goes, it's not all figured out, but you have something here, so hang on to it. I was like, all right. And so when this came along, I was like, this is perfect. Like, it doesn't have to be a feature. Like, it can be like 20 to 30 minutes. And the only thing I didn't have fully fleshed out was who was doing it. Like, who was the killer? And, you know, there were some ideas like, oh, it's just a guy in the woods. And, oh, it's just, you know. But I was like, I also love cult stuff, you know, and you know, I'm really inspired by like, especially like family traditions, and like how they can be great, but they can be super toxic at the same time. And I was like, ooh, there's something really intriguing here. And like, especially if it plays as like a part to this that looks nothing like the other segment. Yeah. And then that's where my pitch came in. And I was like, you guys, hear me out. What if, I know this is like kind of like a, it's kind of like your bookends where like, you know, in 94, you start with the SWAT team coming in, and then you end with the SWAT team, and it's the two girls that like kill. Like, I was like, so it's kind of like that, except it's not bookends. It's like the film happens kind of like, maybe it's the second film in, and then you have two more films, and then you finish it with like a shorter end, like another that you don't know it's a part of it.
Yeah.
And then technically the whole segment wraps up, and then you finish it off with the with another film, and then the end. And they're like, oh. And I remember David Bruckner, who he's a producer. He's been on these things. He's been a producer on these things forever. And he was like, this is really interesting. He goes, let's play with that. Like when we were editing this, let's find out where we can put these. But I like that. And it worked. And everybody was super excited about it. And so that's what we did. And it does. It catches people off guard. And that's exactly what I had hoped it would do. And we made a great villain in Ruth. And and then it was cool. It's like the whole concept was, you know, we always it's a slasher film, but with a mass shooter. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And like that is the horror that we deal with today. It's not necessarily a knife wielding maniac. It's you go to the grocery store and you don't know if you're going to come home.
Like that's so fascinating.
And so for me, it was like, okay, we're always so focused on who the guy who did it is. And there's always a story about him. And then we hear about the victims and then we kind of forget about them.
Yeah.
And the guy who takes the glory is the guy who's taken all the lives, right? I'm like, what if we get to hear from the victim's side? What if they all wake up and we get to hear sort of what they experienced?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then they're actually talking about it. What does it feel like to be like all these things? This is really, it's messed up, but it's also like we spend time with them then,
mm-hmm.
and it becomes something else. And that was sort of that was the concept behind it. And that was to me what made it so different and also horrific. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's the horror of reality, really.
Yeah.
To a degree. Yeah. And it's unfortunate. And it's also, I guess that's so interesting too, because this is not, this VHS film isn't set in modern, like current mm-hmm. times. It is set, mm-hmm. you know, a number of decades ago, yeah. but it's still, nothing about it feels like it's out of place.
Yeah. Yeah. That's exactly it. So, and I mean, you know, we've all grown up now since, you know, the early 90s when this stuff has been going on. It's been a part of our life for, mm-hmm. you know, 30 years.
Yeah.
And so that's, you can sit there and just say, yeah, it happens and ignore it. Or you can, you know, do something with it and say that this is the horror that we live with, and yeah. let's face it head on.
Yeah. And it's so interesting that you brought up the family traditions and the cult aspect too, because you kind of come back to that in Wrong Turn as well. Yeah. It is part of that story too, right?
Yeah.
It's this, you know, like scary cult in the woods really, but like they have this mm-hmm. very particular set of ideals and traditions that they stick to.
Yeah.
You know, and like the sort of horrific things that they inflict on the people that they kidnap and like the women that they take and things like that, obviously. But they, mm-hmm. it's just interesting that it's like, you know, that's it. It's the traditions that you're like, look, traditions can be terrible. And even like in a Christmas movie, you know, sometimes you watch a movie and you're like, yeah, but some families just do this because they feel like they have to get together at the holidays.
Yeah.
It's that like that Krampus thing of it all where everybody's irritated with each other, but oh, this is what mm-hmm. we do every year at Christmas. So I guess we're getting together. Like it's that kind mm-hmm. of feel.
Yeah, that's exactly where that came from. It was just she has a choice. She can either stay and do what her family has told her she needs to do.
Yeah.
Or her cousin says, let's just get out of here. Like they can leave. And she's like, nope. And you're like, oh God. yeah.
It hurts. But it has a great ending. I loved the not particularly ambiguous, but also like the visual of the ending is very, very cool.
She will forever be. Yeah. She's kind of immortalized and can never get what her family says she needs to be.
Yeah.
yeah. She's been baptized.
So I guess just to like wrap things up a little bit so that we don't, you know,
not monopolize your time
of your evening. So we have part of what we do on the podcast that we have like multiple episodes of is we have like a bit of a side series that we call Childhood Trauma, where we revisit a film that one of us watched when we were probably too young, when we were kids. And it gives us the opportunity to re-examine it from a different lens. And it's like our weird little way of therapizing ourselves through whatever thing we watched when we were kids that maybe freaked us out more than it would obviously now. To an extent.
Yeah, some of them make absolutely no sense. Why they freak out. No,
especially yours. Yours are my favorite. but I guess I'm wondering, was there a film that you watched at a very early age in some capacity that you feel maybe would be worth re-examining or that even still gets you as an adult that you're like surprised that you're like, oh, this still holds up and still scares me?
Yes. I mean, there's a couple actually, you know, cause I remember going over to some sleepovers and sneaking in a few R-rated films. I remember just going to my friend's house across the street, sleeping over and watching White Man Can't Jump, you know, when you're like, when I was like nine or something like that. And not under like being like, oh my God. but in that same night, I remember very specifically watching Toy Soldiers.
Okay.
And
I remember that.
That one, I still think of that movie. And I remember watching it recently again, maybe within the last like 4 or 5 years, and being shocked at what was going on in that movie. Cause it like took terrorism in like a really, like it was like terrorism at a college. They're taking out, you know, what is it like 18 year old kids?
Yeah.
You know, they're throwing women off the sides of buildings. Like you're just, I mean, when you're young and you see that kind of stuff, you're just like, oh my God. And I saw it again. I just remember being like, holy shit. Like that's hardcore, dude. Like that, like I'm trying to, and then you start to think about like horror movies where you're, cause I deal in horror movies. I'm dealing with violent subject matter a lot of times. And I'm just like, why do I feel that this violence in this situation is far scarier than some of like the scary movies that I watched? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
And so, yeah, that's one that surprisingly affected me when I was very young. Cause I was like, oh my God, that's terrifying. And then watched it again as an adult fairly recently and was like, I still feel like weird watching this movie. yeah, I don't know. I mean, again, it comes down to that whole thing. It's like kids swearing a lot, you know, yep. Saying things they shouldn't be. And like, you know, they're, you know, they've left home, they're at the school and, you know, and then this crazy stuff happens. Like I think it is the Jewish kid who like grabs the gun and like runs down and tries to shoot one of the terrorists and the gun climbs and you're like, that's exactly what would happen too. It's like, it's not like an action movie thing where he can just like waste a bunch of people. He goes and shoots and it recoils up, which,
of course.
And then he gets taken out and you're kind of like, you're shell shocked actually. Cause you're just like, oh my God, one of the friends just bit it. And that he was like a main character.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would have to say Toy Soldiers.
Mm-hmm. That's a good choice.
Yeah.
That makes sense. Yeah. That's it. See, again, horror of reality. It's the thing.
Yeah. I mean, yeah.
And look at that. You watched that film when you were very young, and then lo and behold, did come up with an idea later to have basically a short about an active shooter in a situation. So, I mean, these things stick with you.
Yeah, exactly. That's
it. Yeah. I mean, it's so interesting. The more and more that I have these conversations and I see sort of like things that my work does, I'm like, yeah, there were things that I grew up with that definitely left an impression and maybe didn't fully realize what it was coming from. And then you start to look back, you're like, oh yeah, that was definitely did something.
Yeah.
Mini therapy. That's okay.
Okay.
That's
good. Yeah. No, it's fine. It's your way of working through it. You know, it's your way of working through it. There's nothing wrong with
that. That's what's great about just art in general. And I mean, for me, and that's filmmaking. It's just, you do get to work through some of those things. And I think the more honest you can be about those things when doing that, it works better. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? When you're, you know, when you're hiding behind something, or you're not fully ready to fully commit to an angle on something, then you feel there's a void there, and it's not fully, it's not packing the punch that it could. Mm-hmm. And when you do, you know that you've done something special, and it feels like a part of you, and you're like, oh, well, there's a reason why it's a part of me, because I saw this thing, or I was part of this growing up, or, you know, like, you know, cause I grew up going to church every Sunday, you know what I mean? In Sunday school and youth group. And so, like, you know, not to say that my segment in VHS or Wrong Turn had anything to do with that, but I was also like, but I grew up in a community, you know, that, you know, had certain beliefs. And so being able to like, say, like, it's rooted in, I really believe that this is real. And this is how things are. This is how things are supposed to be. You're like, okay, do that. Like, this is what it should be then.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, then you pull from that, some of those experiences, and the more honest I think you can be, the better.
Yeah.
As scary as it can be at times.
That's it. That's totally fair.
Yeah.
You know, hopefully this conversation is not a downer for your evening on a Monday.
I have to have these conversations. I mean, when I'm writing stuff, like, you have to get real sometimes and be like,
yeah,
do I want to do this? Sometimes I do have to step back and say, this isn't something I want to explore. This isn't my thing. Yeah.
This
you go another way, and you tell a different story. But if something feels right, and something that's been on your mind for a while, then you have to do it.
Yeah, it's important. Put it down on paper for sure. Yep. I guess two more questions for you. One is going to be a fun one, so we turn away from this.
We do have a very small, silly little game if you're up for it.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Sure.
I was looking that you have a movie that is in post production right now, the Buonia, I think it's called, Legend of the Amazon. Yes, that's it. Thank you. About a giant snake, from what I understand.
A monster.
Yeah, a monster movie.
In the Amazon, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'm looking, it's supposed to be released in Netherlands. Is it coming to the US? Can you tell us more about it, please?
It is. They haven't officially released the date here yet, okay, but it'll be this year.
Okay. Yeah, it's supposed to be August, right, in Netherlands or something like that? So
yes, okay. Somehow that they sold the territory there, like, instantly. That's all right. I know about that. So North 5/6, which is our international sales, looks like they got their deal locked and sold. Lionsgate, who's doing domestic on it, they're planning, again, it's either going to be late quarter three, early quarter four.
Oh, cool. Okay.
And yeah,
we just pay attention to the releases because we're in Canada. So, you know, when it trickles over to the States, we can be like, oh, good, great, 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 great. We'll get it right after.
Yeah. No, it'll be a wider release.
Nice.
I'm really excited for that one. Like, that one is that one means a whole lot to me. And again, talking about, never thought I'd do a Wrong Turn, never thought I'd do a Silent Night, Deadly Night, never in a million years did I think I'd do a giant snake movie.
But in the Amazon rainforest, wow. Oof.
It actually go down to Colombia, stay in Leticia, get on a boat, shoot on the actual Amazon River, shoot in the jungle with all the snakes and the spiders, in the 98-degree weather with 100% humidity, like, everybody's just sweating, everybody's dirty. It was just like, wow. Like, you had this moment where you're, cause like, Sorcerer is one of my favorite movies. And, you're like, whereas, you know, we maybe didn't do it as crazy or maybe as illegal of things as that they did in that movie. But there were times when, you know, I was talking with our producer, who's Jeremy Bolt. He did the Resident Evil films. He did Event Horizon.
Wow.
So working with him was actually pretty incredible. Both him and I love Sorcerer, and we had these moments where, like, I mean, I don't want to, like, speak out of turn here, but it kind of feels like we're in it, man. Like Billy Friedkin, like, did it, like, and you're kind of cut off, and you're out in this jungle area, and you're running around, and you're.
It must be so different, because I'm sure, yes, there's a crew, there are medics, and there are things, but you're like, I don't know. What if something does happen? I don't know what we're going to do about it.
There was plenty of infrastructure that you had to figure out, and how you were going to do it. And if there were sometimes ways, things that you just, well, we can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, how do we do this? And then it's like figuring it out. It's always a puzzle. And yeah. Yeah. A lot of safety things. But again, like everybody was full bore to get that one done. And really gave it their all, both in front of and behind camera. They just freaking killed it, dude.
Yeah, I mean, it has a great cast. Also, you're back with working with Alan McElroy,
right?
As a writer, yeah. So I think you've got a good crew of people you've worked with in the past on this one as well.
Yes, yeah. So yeah, I teamed back up with him. And then, of course, Robert Kalzer, who also produced Wrong Turn, produced this one as well.
Mm-hmm. Nice.
So it was a Constantine project, which again, Wrong Turn was Constantine, got taken by Lionsgate. This is also Constantine, got taken by Lionsgate. So it's a cool, and yeah, it's a fun survival film, and it's got a lot of heart, and it's dirty, it's sweaty, it's raw. We got to work with like real local, like non-actors, and you know, work in some of these villages and these areas. It was just half the film is subtitled, like it takes place, like we are there, and it is a very, very Spanish-speaking movie. We're right there, Colombia and Brazil.
That's awesome.
That's
I'm looking forward to that. I think
yeah, seriously, really cool. Definitely looking forward to it. Okay, so as I guess a last thing, we have kind of like a horror matchup for a bracket. In terms of the movies that you would let's say movies that you like, movie that you would definitely watch, like
the preferred, preferred of the two that we kind of like shoot out.
Yeah, that's it. I chose a couple of movies that, you know, we've seen a couple of movies that we think you would have definitely seen. There's not too many because I don't want to do like a 20 bracket.
Oh, God.
Take hours. So we'll start off with the first one. Wrong Turn, the original one,
2003.
Versus Hills Have Eyes, the 2006 one.
Oh, boy. You're pitting up Alan with Alexander Aja and Maxime, who Maxime shot Domestics.
Oh,
and I've been a huge Alexander Aja fan, like ever since I did.
I'm sorry.
No, this is good. This is good. Right now, okay. Right now, I'm gonna go with Wrong Turn. In this moment, I'm gonna go Wrong Turn.
Okay,
perfect. Registered. Next bracket, Midsommar or The Menu?
Midsommar.
Okay.
Perfect. Registered.
Oh,
you want to do the next
yeah,
one?
Yeah, this one's it's a Stephen King mashup. So
because you know Stephen King.
Yeah. The Shining or Carrie?
The Shining.
Yeah. Okay.
Perfect.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's the comedy one. Cabin in the Woods or Shaun of the Dead?
Cabin in the Woods.
Okay. Cabin in the Woods. All right. So our next bracket.
Now we're down to pitting them against
each other. So we have Wrong Turn or Midsommar.
Oh my gosh! Okay, now we're working down.
Yep.
Right? Yeah. Like it's a.
Oh my gosh!
We're gonna have to get to an ultimate favorite in this.
Yeah. Okay, sure. We're gonna go Midsommar.
Okay.
God, I just love like that movie. Makes me feel so weird inside. The horror of that movie is something. I don't know if I ever felt that before. So yes,
it's the scariest breakup film I've ever watched in my entire life.
And it doesn't hide
terrifying.
It.
Yeah.
No, it's not night. It's not nothing.
No.
It's really just
no. It's so scary.
Daylight. Mm-hmm.
It's so disconcerting to watch. You're just kind of like uncomfortable the whole time.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then yes. Okay. So then the second bracket is now The Shining or Cabin in the Woods.
Oh. In terms of just like wanting to watch, because they're both great movies. I love them.
Yes, of course.
But in terms of what I'd want to watch right now, I'm going to have to go with... Boy, that's tough.
Making you work a bit.
I'm going to have to say... I'm going to go Cabin in the Woods.
Okay.
All right.
And so then, yeah, so then we have the final bracket means that it's Midsommar versus Cabin in the Woods.
Yeah. And, you know, honestly, I think it's just the mood I'm in right now. And the fact that, like, I don't know if it's what I've been writing lately, or let's just put it this way. Right now, I'm in more of a mood for a feel good horror, and that would be Cabin in the Woods.
Yep.
All right.
There's nothing feel good about it.
No, there's not. I mean, gosh, it's a great movie, but like, yes. It's also one of those movies that, like, not quite sure. You know, it's like one of those, like, once or twice a year, maybe once a year, once a couple of years. I don't know.
Yeah. It's not like a pop it on for fun movie.
No, but
Cabin in the Woods is always a pop it on for fun movie.
Kevin, like, I cannot wait actually to show my son, who's, I think, a little young for it now, but like, because he's of course seen me make all these scary movies, and like, I've introduced him to some stuff, and so he's very aware of like monsters and creatures and different characters and stuff like that. And that movie, where it goes, I think his mind would be blown. That end sequence, I think he would just love on its own.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah,
because it's just like monsters just wrecking havoc.
That's it.
I just remember how surprising that was. I went into that movie blind, and I'm so glad that I did, because when nobody it turned the way that it did, no, I was like,
that's it.
I was like, whoa, what movie am I in right now? And then it builds on it. It's not just, okay, well, we're setting it up at the beginning and something's going to happen. No, it's not just that. It's, oh yeah, we're going to allow you to do the thing. We're going to allow you to do the thing that all the people watching the movie, we want to do. So these characters get to go into that lab.
Yeah.
There you go.
Yeah. It's just, it's great. Not we'll see. Good. And I thought the movie was going to end after she went in like the cubes.
Yes.
And you saw all the characters. I thought it was going to pull out, and then it was just going to be like,
nope.
And I was, and they didn't. And I was like, and I remember my brother had seen the movie before I did. And he took me to it. He's like, you have to see this movie. He goes, I want to be next to you when you watch it.
Yeah.
And then of course it kept going and blah, blah, blah. And then of course the elevators start coming. And he didn't watch the movie. He just went like this and was looking at me, because he could just see it was like, it was literally like how I would play with my G.I. Joes when I was like, you know, 8 years old, because I had all my monster figures and all my G.I. Joes, and I had a bunch of broken G.I. Joes. And so what I'd do is I'd take those broken G.I. Joes and I'd set them up, and I'd have the queen alien come and rip them apart, and like their head and stuff would go flying. And so to see all those monsters come down and just tear those SWAT guys apart was just like, I'm 10.
That
is exactly why it's the ultimate winner.
It kind of is.
Yeah. There we go. At least for tonight, for sure.
Yeah, for today.
Yeah.
Nice. Thank you so much. That was really fun. It was really great. Thank you so much for, again, taking the time to talk to us. You know what? If we can reach out to you when the Legend on Amazon comes out, that would be great. We can talk to you about it again. That would be really cool, awesome, because
we'd really like to. We'd really like to check it out and then be able to chat with you about it, because it sounds like it's going to be a really interesting experience.
Yeah, it's like I said, it's we did something really fun and special with it. It's got a lot to it. You know, it's a heavy movie. It's a good answer to what, like, you know, we just got Anaconda, and it's a good, very much the opposite answer to that movie. So whereas Anaconda was a lot of fun and kind of a ride, ours is very, we'll just say, it's a little bit more grim. but in a really great way. We still carry the heart through, but it's
beefy. Awesome. Looking forward to it for sure.
Thank you again so much to Mike P. Nelson for hopping on with us. This was such a blast. We had such a good time with this entire conversation. I think everybody's probably pretty excited for everything that he's kind of got going on right now. I can't wait to see That's It, his new film. Hopefully before the end of this year, it would be awesome. It's got like a really stacked cast, and it sounds like it's going to be such a good time.
And a bunch of writers are coming back that he's worked in the past with. So like, it just looks like it's going to be great.
Oh, it sounds like it's going to be so great. And we also just had such a fun time just chatting with him about general horror stuff. This was such a cool, like, kind of look behind the curtain to a degree into the world of somebody who kind of works with this stuff full time, that we really love to go see and talk about.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So Yeah, so if you like those kind of interviews and the other stuff that we do, remember to follow us on our socials at Gravetone Pod on every social media account. That is the handle.
Yeah. And you can also check out our website at gravetonepod.com. All of our episodes are there. All of our interviews are there that are all archived as well. And you can check out our little horror movie picker quiz anytime you would like to, which we're consistently adding new titles to as we see new films as well.
Yeah.
Anyway, in the meantime, guys, stay scared and stay tuned.
Ciao, guys.